This is After Dark number 5, this is tape number 2, and this is side number 1. Right now we're going to be taking a look at an article which appeared in DX News Magazine from June 20th, 1994, volume 61, number 27. The article is entitled Tracking the 1994 Solar Eclipse by Radio, and it's written by the National Radio Club publication chairperson, Ken Chatterton. So let's take a look at this article right now. The sole purpose of this little experiment was to see just what happens, rather than explore any particular scientific theory. During the May 10th, 1994 solar eclipse at my location in northern New York, just to the east of Lake Ontario. In preparation, I sought to find four frequencies on which I did not have a strong local, yet one on which there was a normally weak signal. Why four frequencies? No, four is not a magic number, other than it was just the number of radios that I had available, and also the number of loop antennas available. I was also able to round up three reliable tape recorders, leaving one radio to monitor directly, and also tape with an unreliable recorder. I steered away from the graveyard channels because the vast multitude of signals would have made it very difficult to ID what was being heard. I also needed frequencies with two or more stations to my northeast, that is Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, and Quebec, and the Maritimes of Canada. This proved to be the hardest part of all. The frequencies chosen and the equipment used were as follows. 550 kHz and a Collins R390 with a National Radio Club designed 4-foot loop antenna. 1220 kHz and a realistic DX-160 with space magnet 2. 1330 kHz and a Zenith M660 all-band set with only its own internal ferrite rod. And 1360 kHz and a Helicrafters SX-26 with space magnet 1 antenna. By using loop antennas, I hope to have directional pickup both ways along the lines of the eclipse. I began to monitor at 12 noon Eastern Time and ended up monitoring at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, May 10th. The eclipse reached maximum at approximately 1:30 Eastern Daylight Time at this location. In the breakdown that follows, I have not listed exact times, referring instead to the state of eclipse beginning, one-half into, nearly complete, complete, coming out of, one-half out, and nearly over. Not truly scientific, perhaps, but it serves a purpose. All four receivers were pre-tuned. The antennas arranged as nearly parallel as possible, and the tape recorders timed so as not to need changing at the same moment. A timer was set up to alert me when the first tape should be nearly out. Now to the results. At 550 kHz, we started with WGR Buffalo, New York. It was weak, clearly audible, and alone. As time progressed, something appeared under WGR with talk. Minutes later, a second talker appeared. About halfway in, one talker was ID'd as WLWA Cincinnati, Ohio. And the second talker disappeared. KSD St. Louis possible on that assigned frequency, but not ideable. Buffalo was still well atop. At maximum, Buffalo strong atop with Cincinnati strong underneath, and running a poor third, one with AC music, that's adult contemporary. As the peak passed, Cincinnati faded quickly, then vanished. Buffalo faded. And WDEV, Waterbury, Vermont, rose to equal, then gradually surpassed Buffalo. Waterbury was the station with the adult contemporary music. With the eclipse about half over, Buffalo faded, and while I think was still there, was not discernible. A French speaker was noted very weakly under WDEV. CHLN, Trois-Rivières, Quebec, would be most likely, but no ID was ever heard. A third signal was present briefly, and I think I heard a CFNB ID. If so, it was Fredericton, New Brunswick. Within the next 7 minutes, all traces of the latter two disappeared, leaving WDEV alone, but rapidly weakening. With the eclipse still some 15 minutes short of ending, WDEV faded away, and a weak WGR Buffalo was once alone again. On 1220 kHz, we start off with CHSC in St. Catharines, Ontario. It was very weak but ideable, with an extremely weak someone, likely CJSS in Cornwall, Ontario, underneath. As things progressed, CHSC improved, CJSS vanished, and oldies music faded in very weakly. There was United States Radio Network news there. Minutes later, canned religion was fading in and gradually came up equal to CHSC. The oldie station gave one ID, and it may have ended with a Q. KCGQ Cape Girardeau, Missouri is possible, as it is on the right alignment. The religious station never ID'd. But in one promo mentioned to tune in here to the Radio Ridge, Log says WSLM in Salem, Indiana uses this slogan. As Maximum approached, the religion faded and was replaced by WKNR Cleveland, Ohio. At peak darkness, actually dimness, WKNR and CHSC were even with CJSS a poor third. Over the next 20 minutes, WKNR faded out and CJSS rose to equal, then gradually gone. CJSS dominated with a talk station and a French speaker underneath. The French speaker mentioned Quebec several times, and I caught a partial ID, KSM, IDing this as CKSM, in Shawinigan Falls, Quebec. The talker now, running third, may have mentioned the Connecticut Valley, making WKBK in Keene, New Hampshire, a possible for that one. There was briefly a Canadian-accented English speaker underway. CKCW in Moncton, New Brunswick, would be the only English-speaking Canadian left in the northeast direction on this frequency. Then just about the last quarter of the eclipse, within about 5 minutes, everyone but CJSS faded. Before that eclipse ended, CHSC was back weakly, but now under a not quite as weak CJSS. On 1330 kHz, we start off with WFWC in Springville, New York, very weak and barely ideable. A quarter way into the eclipse, WFWC was getting stronger but still weak with gospel music underneath. No ID, but did catch a mention of Southern Indiana. WVHI in Evansville would be on the right alignment. The gospel slowly gave way to country music, still well under Springville. The only remotely ID-able item heard was a phone number ending with 3000. The National Radio Club log says WTRE in Greensburg, Indiana has such a phone number, so it may be them. As Maximum approached, WFIN in Findlay, Ohio faded up atop briefly with an ID and ads. Then someone with what seemed to be all sports came in. WFIN faded shortly, leaving Sports, a format which fits Camel, Ohio, and a rapidly rising WEYZ in Erie, Ohio. Erie quickly rose to dominate, and while no ID was heard, there were numerous mentions of Erie and Western Pennsylvania. At peak, WEYZ and WFWC were about equal, with a French speaker coming up under them. Over the next half hour, WEYZ and WFWC slowly weakened as the French speaker improved. I did not hear any ID or anything else in my limited French could understand, but CKLD remained until well into the last quarter of the eclipse, gradually fading all the while. As CKLD faded out, there was nothing else audible, no Springville, even. I checked about 1 hour after the eclipse ended, and Springville was back on then as usual, but very weak. 1360 kHz. Now at the start, a very weak WMNS in Olean, New York. Usually present WKOP in Binghamton, New York, was nulled by the antenna's southwest-northeast aiming. Nothing else noted until nearly halfway into the eclipse, when religion could be heard very weakly, and some 5 minutes before being replaced with country and western music, which also never got strong enough to ID. At one point, there were ads on, but nothing to indicate a location. A couple of minutes later, I thought I heard, here in southern Illinois, and also down in Evansville, WYER Mount Carmel is possible, as it is in southern Illinois, near the Indiana border, about 25 miles north of Evansville, Indiana. Within minutes, the country music was gone, replaced by talk, which was mostly sports. The talk and sports proved to be Cincinnati, Ohio. As peak approached, Cincinnati was dominant at fair strength, with WMNS just underneath, with someone with country music running a poor third. WWOW in Conant, Ohio, was one of the stations I expected to hear, and per the National Radio Club log, they run country and western music. At the peak passed, a French speaker began fading in as Cincinnati faded out. Within a half hour after the peak, the French speaker was dominant and totally covered any others that might have been there. The French speaker had some nice identifiable ads and promos and several clear CKRB IDs, such as CKRB 1460 St. George. So I clearly had CJVL in Quebec, which is listed as relaying CKRB during the daytime. By the halfway point out of the eclipse, someone with a mix of country and adult standards was noted very, very weak. I am fairly sure that at one point they said, the Bay's best music. In any case, the only station shown on the 1360 map further northeast is CKBC in Bathurst, New Brunswick. These two were just the beginning to fade down when monitoring on this channel came to an abrupt halt as the helicopter's power transformer began to overheat. This development was not unexpected, as this receiver seldom can be operated more than 2 or 2.5 hours at one time before producing a burning smell, the main reason it's used very little right now. At the peak of the eclipse, the conditions here similar to sunrise and sunset, that is, no darkness more than dimness. All four frequencies seemed about equal, with 550 kHz reaching from Ohio, possibly Missouri, to Quebec, 1220 reaching from Missouri to New Brunswick, counting possibles, 1330 reaching from Indiana to Quebec, and 1360 from Illinois to New Brunswick. Give or take a little, this is just about what one could expect to hear at sunrise or sunset. Nothing spectacular was heard. In fact, all the stations identified have been logged here at some time in the past, with the exception of CJVL. A report is off to CJVL, by the way. Of the possible or tentative stations, only KCGQ 1220 in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, would be new here. Too bad that one wasn't a tad bit better. But then I did land one new station, so I guess one shouldn't be greedy. All in all, it was a very enjoyable 3 hours that may not have proved anything else except that DXing is fun. If anyone else tried something similar during this time, I would like to hear from you. Write to Ken Chatterton, Chatterton, at the National Radio Club Publication Center, Post Office Box 164, Mansville, New York, 13661, USA.
Radio Netherlands Receiver Test Laboratory.
Today we're reviewing a new radio from the Sony Corporation of Japan. It's the ICF SW7600G. It's been out for about a week in the USA, a little longer in Asia where we purchased our sample, and it will appear in Europe around the end of this month. Neville Gray joins me with our laboratory test results.
At first glance through a shop window, you could be forgiven for thinking that the SW7600G is just a cosmetic upgrade of its predecessor, the ICF SW7600, which has been around for 4 years now. But it's not. Remember, the so-called 7600 line has been around in various versions for 10 years now. Back in 1984, the ICF 7600D was launched in most parts of the world, except in North America, where it was known as the ICF 2002, to identify the US version from grey imports from the Far East. By August 87, the price had dropped to $250 across Europe, and with a change in colour, it became known as the ICF 7600DS, or the ICF 2003. But the shortwave performance of all these radios was, for all intents and purposes, identical.
In January 1990, Sony upgraded its 7600 receiver, renaming it the ICF SW7600, adding stereo to the FM portion of the radio and improving the single sideband performance. There was now a selector for upper or lower sideband. But the price was still around $250. With the launch of the ICF SW7600G, Sony has made a significant improvement to the receiver and cut the price by more than $50 in many markets, significantly more here in Europe, where it will retail at the end of next week at 399 Dutch guilders. That's about £150 sterling.
The letter G in the new type number is very significant, because Sony is the first to bring the price of a receiver with synchronous detection below the $200 mark. The technique sounds complicated when you have to explain it over the radio, but in practice it is a feature which portable owners in the price class above $350 have come to expect. You may know that most shortwave broadcast transmitters active today broadcast in what is called the AM mode, which means that it consists of two components. The so-called carrier wave, which puts the signal on a particular frequency, and two identical sidebands either side of the carrier frequency, which carry the music or speech that you're trying to listen to. The carrier doesn't really carry any useful information with it, apart from being a reference. Most radios simply discard the carrier, leaving the sum of the two sidebands containing the programming. The problem comes if you're listening to a weak signal that's just 5 kHz from a powerhouse signal that you don't want to hear. Let's take a classic example in Europe, namely Radio Luxembourg in German on 6090 kHz, right next to the Bayerischer Rundfunk in Munich, which up here in Holland is difficult to pick out on many portables. The upper sideband of Bayerischer Rundfunk on 6085 is just swamped by the more powerful lower sideband of Radio Luxembourg running on 6090 kHz.
A receiver with synchronous detection like the ICF SW7600G offers a possible solution. A very stable oscillator is used inside the receiver, so you can listen in a sort of automatic single sideband mode. You select synchronous detection, and the receiver's internal oscillator locks onto the carrier of the signal you're trying to hear. Now you can select the sideband furthest away from the interference, so in this case 6085 kHz lower sideband. Because of the set locks onto the carrier automatically, you don't have to worry about adjusting controls to make the pitch of the music or speech sound normal, which is something you'd have to do on a receiver without synchronous detection. Let's have a demonstration. This is Radio Luxembourg in the middle of a sponsored religious program in German. We'll tune down now to 6085, where Bayerischer Rundfunk is running a music program. And you can hear the splatter from Luxembourg using the normal AM mode. If I now select sync mode and upper sideband, there's not a lot of difference because of the mixing of the two sidebands. Now I'll select lower sideband and the splatter should be gone altogether. Listening to a station using one sideband instead of two also reduces the problem of selective fading, especially during deep fades. You notice there's less distortion if you're using the sync mode as opposed to ordinary AM.
You can tune the radio by tapping in the frequency directly on the keypad and pressing an execute button. An improvement, in fact, over the ICF SW7600, which was a bit more clumsy. The key with the number 5 on it has a raised blip, making it easy for blind listeners to orientate themselves and push the right key. That feature disappeared for a few years on the ICF SW7600. You can also manually scan up and down the band in 5 or 1 kHz steps using cleverly designed up and down buttons arranged in an arc shape. This idea appeared earlier this year on the more expensive ICF SW100. You can scan automatically, looking for strong stations too. The fact that the radio jumps up and down the band in finer steps than the older models and has a much stabler internal oscillator makes it much easier to tune in amateur radio operators using full SSB. You still have to clarify the signal using a thumb wheel on the side of the radio, but it's much easier than in the past, and the radio stays locked onto the signal without noticeable frequency drift.
The ICF SW7600G offers continuous coverage between 150 up to 29999 kHz in the AM mode and 76 to 108 MHz on FM, covering the bands used in most parts of the world, including the Far East. The version on sale in Italy, though, has a chunk of shortwave missing because of national legislation. On medium wave, the fine tuning is 1 kHz, and there's a small switch in the battery compartment allowing you to select between 9 or 10 kHz for the coarse tuning step. That's because radio stations in the Americas are 10 kHz apart, 9 kHz elsewhere in the world. Without the feature, you would have to jump from channel to channel and keep having to retune all the time.
The liquid crystal display is clear, although it only shows the time when the radio is switched off and the frequency to the nearest 1 kHz when switched on. The radio has a dual timer function, but unlike the older ICF SW7600, there's no jack on the side of the receiver to remotely switch a tape recorder. If you were using a Walkman-type cassette recorder to record what you hear, then there's a line output with a constant level. On FM, though, that output is in mono. You only get stereo reception on FM by plugging into the headphone socket. The set now offers 22 memories, more than double that of the older models. 10 are for AM, 10 for FM, and there are 2 which can be stored with the frequencies of favorite radio stations to wake you up in the morning.
When it comes to performance, the dual heterodyne design does well for a radio of this type. The intercept point is around -6 dBm, but here in Europe we suggest you forget about an external antenna for nighttime listening. In more remote parts of the world, though, a simple long-wire antenna might be required for improved daytime reception of higher frequencies. Any overloading when using the telescopic whip can easily be reduced by collapsing the antenna a bit. The set comes complete with a washing line type of antenna, which is useful on trips. The ICF SW7600G is certainly selective enough for the international radio listener. The filter specifications are tighter than on previous models, and that is noticeable in the slightly more muffled audio. The synchronous detection mode compensates for the lack of a second bandwidth filter. There have clearly been some changes to the audio section of the set. Battery consumption is down to 50 milliamps at normal listening levels, and we got about 23 hours of life out of a new set of 4 alkaline batteries. One reason for the price drop, though, in some countries is due to the fact that the AC power supply is no longer included in the package. The ICF SW7600G uses the new Japanese 6-volt DC power standard. So if you do buy a separate power supply, do check that it has the new smaller type of plug on it and that the polarity is therefore correct. The batteries should be kept in the radio at all times, even when an external power supply is connected, because that ensures that the stations programmed in the memory are retained. You've got about 10 minutes to change the batteries before the radio resets itself.
A two-position tone control is active on both AM and FM. It simply cuts the treble response when activated. Like older models, the radio has a cleverly designed on-off switch which can be locked. This is useful when the set is packed in a suitcase and you don't want it to spring to life when knocked about. In short, the Sony ICF-SW7600G is a very clever package at a reasonable price. So far, no one else has managed to offer the synchronous detection feature on a radio under $200. Performance on the ICF-SW7600G is similar to the new and much more expensive ICF-SW100, but without the extended page-by-page memory tuning. We think the identically priced Grundig Yachtboy 400 sounds better on its own internal speaker. But for dynamic selectivity, the sync feature on the Sony has the edge, and the synthesizer noise is lower.
And as usual, a printed copy of that report will be available from us by the end of the month, as well as being electronically posted on the internet.
The Sony SRF-42 AM Stereo Walkman Review by Frank Aiden Jr. The Sony SRF-42 is a recently issued, as of December 1993, stereo radio that I believe is the only stereo CQAM radio currently available to the public. When I first heard of the radio on the market, I called over 20 different Sony offices in North America before I was able to confirm that the radio did exist and where I could obtain one. I suspect this radio is going to be a marketing failure if Sony does not make it easier to find. It is apparent that they are limiting the number of locations where it can be bought, which I feel is a major mistake. Sony has a new magazine, around $5, found in most larger stores, which is just a glorified catalog, and does list this radio. I found the radio available at the Sony-only store in Portland, Oregon, at 1610 Northwest Gleason, G-L-I-S-A-N, Portland, Oregon, 97209. Their telephone number is area code 503-224-9400. They will take credit card orders via phone. They quoted me a price of only $29, but charged me only $26. List price is $34.95. The radio is small, slightly larger than the Sony SRF-39, measuring about 4.5 inches by 2.75 by 0.5 inches. Band coverage is from 530 kHz to 1710 kHz, plus 87.6 to 108 MHz FM. The SRF-42 uses a small ferrite loopstick AM antenna, typical of most Walkman-type radios. Selectivity and sensitivity is about average for a Walkman radio. With careful tuning, I can pick out many of the stereo stations heard in the area. Sound quality is very good. Listening to KBOI on 670 with their 40% stereo separation sounds almost as good as listening to FM. When I tune to distant AM stereo stations, the usual platforming distortion can be noticed, especially when moving the antenna around. The only complaint that I have with this radio is with the volume control. When it is set at minimum, it still puts out a moderate level of audio. The SRF-42 runs off two AA batteries. It has no external port jack. Battery life is listed at 48 hours for FM and 40 hours for AM. I have already exceeded that with my first set of batteries, so it does not appear to be a problem, compared to that of the Sony stereo radio which was available several years ago. Hooking up an outboard loop antenna via the headphone jack makes the radio fun to tune around with, looking for AM stereo signals. Also, hooking up the SRF-42 to a stereo system can be a pleasant surprise if there is a strong AM signal available in your area. For its price, the Sony SRF-42 is a bargain if you want an AM stereo radio. As expected, this is not a DX machine, but it can provide for some interesting AM stereo DXing. This article was written by Frank Aiden Jr., and it's entitled Sony SRF-42 AM Stereo Walkman Review. I'm Fred Vobey.
You are listening to KBRW Barrow. It is 11 o'clock. A lot of interesting people pass through Barrow. And John Bowker is here speaking with us today, and I have to ask, what brings you to Barrow?
My wife and I are in Barrow because, first of all, and for the most important reason, we've never been here. We travel a great deal, and as you pointed out, we live in Florida, during the winter months, and we are sensible enough not to live in Florida during the summer months. So we're taking a state at a time during our retirement, and this month is Alaska.
And when we are recording this, this happens to be the first day of summer, and it's snowing, so maybe...
We noticed that. In fact, my wife took my picture today at noon, when the sun presumably would be at the highest point normally, and we noticed the long shadows. So we're learning a great deal. We've met some wonderful people in Barrow, and we're delighted to be here.
Great. You have a particular interest in KBRW because of your professional career, and could you explain that to us?
Oh, dear. I'm a retired broadcaster, at least in part, and... So any radio station operation that varies ever so slightly from what I would have to call the norm is of great interest to me. And KBRW, after all, if anyone in this area is listening to the radio, they're listening to KBRW. I think you're the only radio station that can make the claim 24 hours a day you have a 100 Nielsen rating or whatever.
Can I put that on my resume?
You certainly can.
I'm here to... Now, how many years were you in broadcasting?
Well, I started in 1949, and I haven't counted it up. In fact, Diana, this is the first time in 2 years I've actually been on the air. We do an audio cassette program for blind and physically handicapped radio listeners and international sort of thing. People who love to listen to the radio day and night, particularly at night, seeing what distant stations they can hear.
Oh, really?
Oh, indeed. And some people have received letters verifying their listening habits from 4,000 and 5,000 radio stations. And incidentally, I'm talking only the AM stations, such as KBRW. No FM, no shortwave. And it's kind of an exciting hobby, particularly for those who simply are not able to enjoy television or get out of the house and things like that. And we put out a monthly program on cassette tapes that lasts 90 minutes and tells people what's new in broadcasting. And my humble contribution is the history of radio for a five-minute segment. And then a 13.5-minute segment each month is just having people hear how radio stations sound. For instance, 680 on the dial. I can't tell you this minute how many stations there are in the United States alone, but there are probably 20 or so. And when it comes up 680's turn next time, KBRW will be part of that cassette tape. So oh. I'm excited to have that.
Very good, very good. And we're glad to be a part of that. Is there a name of the organization that produces?
Yes, the National Radio Club is the primary organization. The cassette service is called the DX Audio Service. DX Audio, DXAS for short. And the National Radio Club is centered in Mansfield, New York State. I don't have the zip code. It's P.O. Box 164, I remember that. And we have some 700 members who are actively taking part. We have an annual meeting, which I will be attending this year, I'm delighted to say, in Nashua, New Hampshire, over the Labor Day weekend. And it's kind of a kick to get all these people together and see who our audience is, and I'm sure they enjoy it too.
Let's go back in time, if you don't mind. If you started in broadcasting in 1949, then you've seen a lot of interesting things. I'm wondering, you know, besides the advent of television in every home, mm-hmm. what would you consider to be the most significant change?
Oh, the LP record. Oh, dear, yes. In 1949, I was still in college, and I almost flunked out of school operating a radio station because we only had 2.5 to 3.5 minutes for me to do homework between making announcements for the next record. You're grinning at me, Diana, but it's true. When the LPs came in, my grades went up enough so that I was ultimately valedictorian of my class, and I'm not kidding. That was by far... Oh, now there was one other slight advancement, too, and that's called magnetic tape recording. In 1949, we had 78 RPM records. My voice falls. By 1952, we had magnetic tape and LP records. And the world was totally different. We could have delayed broadcasts without the big, perhaps you've never seen, the big transcription records that were 16, 18 inches in diameter.
And you could serve dinner on.
Right? You could serve dinner, except they were very flexible. That's right. And Of course, the reason I mention LP records first is that the magnetic tape players and recorders cost, $400 or $500. That would be nearly $1 million in 1990 dollars, I guess. And we simply couldn't afford that kind of money. So we converted everything to three-speed phonographs because the 45 came in about a month after the LP. That's a wonderful story, too. Sometime you must ask someone the race between CBS and RCA to get the two record systems going. But the 45 clearly won out in many respects. But from a broadcaster standpoint, it had to be the LP because the needle would conveniently go right into the next song with only a brief pause, and that made it very easy for us.
So then you couldn't put on Inagata Davita and run down the hall, I guess.
MacArthur Park was a 4.5-minute record. We could actually have lunch during MacArthur Park, but that was about the only one that we ID'd that way.
Yeah. A 4.5-minute broadcaster lunch. You wore several different hats during your career.
I did, yes. My technical training, my college training was technical, let me put it that way, engineering, physics. And when I was through with school, RCA picked me up, and I worked at the research center in Princeton, New Jersey, called the David Sarnoff Research Center, starting in 1953. That was the beginning of color TV. Well, I can't say that. Color TV was well along, but not approved yet. In fact, the week that I joined RCA Laboratories, the FCC in Washington that regulates all kinds of broadcasting things, had just selected a rotating disc system, which you perhaps don't remember. And that was that in front of the black and white TV set, you had a disc more than twice as big that would whirl around. And it was oil-fed, and of course, if any oil spilled on the lady's rug, well, I won't go any further into that. Anyway, ultimately, the RCA system did win the day with some additions and improvements from a National Television Systems Committee, they call it the NTSC. Which is what the American system is now known as. I joined RCA just at the time so that all the research and development work I did was on color TV, and that made it great. And then as that kind of waned, the interest in research, I should say, then we got into matters of how to delay a television program, and somebody said, why don't we use magnetic tape? Well, everybody knew that magnetic tape was only good for audio, see, for sound, like KBRW would use. And so I got into a film group. That was a bad move, because, of course, magnetic tape, to repeat myself, won the day on that, an Ampex development. So RCA came in about third on that particular one. At which point, I wanted to get back into broadcasting, and so the RCA group offered me an opportunity to take over what was called the RCA Frequency Bureau, and we held all of the licenses on NBC, National Broadcasting Company, radio and broadcast TV stations and everything else, because RCA owned NBC at that time. The microwave, satellite, we had something like 4,000 licenses at one time. And then that kind of came to an end. Very conveniently, as I reached an age where I could retire, the General Electric Company made a bid for and bought RCA, and that was in 1987. So that, of course, RCA TVs are still available, but they're manufactured now by a French company.
I didn't realize that.
CSF Thompson. So RCA as a company no longer exists and hasn't for 7 years. And that's when the day GE actually bought RCA and the papers were signed was my last day. And I retired that day because was no longer able to represent RCA at the Federal Communications Commission because there wasn't any RCA. So, and I say this with a big grin. It was a big relief. I had a wonderful career. As far as broadcasting is concerned, while I was working for NBC, I was able to work weekends and evenings for local broadcasters in Trenton and Princeton, New Jersey. I built a radio station in Nashville, one in Middlebury, Vermont. And it seems like there was another one. I've lost track. In fact, my home now in Sun City Center is the only... Oh, and Princeton Junction, New Jersey, I built a radio station. I knew there was one. That was at a local high school. So Sun City Center in Florida is the only town I've ever lived in where I haven't built a radio station.
Well, you just moved there. you've surely met a lot of interesting people over the course of all those years in broadcasting. Are there any anecdotes, any experiences that stand out in your mind that you'd like to share?
I'm delighted you ask. Yeah, there are so many people. The person that I was very close to for about a week, does that count?
Sure.
Was David Sarnoff. While I was just a young whippersnapper at the research laboratories, they decided they wanted to get two or three tour guides of the David Sarnoff library where all his memorabilia was stored. Sarnoff, by the way, was the one who wrote the famous memo to his boss in the American Marconi Company in 1912 or 14, right after the Titanic disaster, saying that he thought radio had a bright future as a music box in everybody's home. And the general manager patted him on the head and said, there, that'll be all right. And so anyway, as a result of all of that, Sarnoff was the one who really got RCA started. He was not the first general manager, a man named Harbord was. But anyway, Sarnoff came up and poured his own personal fortune into the development of television and almost lost his shirt. Fortunately, not quite. The reason not quite was that television was just coming along when World War II broke out in 1941, at least our involvement. And the government came in and sponsored heavy research on television for military purposes. And that bailed us out very nicely, because television broadcasting, I think, five stations on the air before that, something like that. Sarnoff then wanted a tour guide for his library, and I was one of those selected. And the anecdote I wanted to relate to you was that with this large room, half the size of a football field, all just glass and aluminum and beautiful display cases like in a museum of ships that were given him by the Japanese government for his role in single-handedly selecting the frequencies, the radio transmitting characteristics that could be used after World War II for all of the Pacific nations. Sarnoff did this himself, with help. By the way, from my predecessor in the RCA Frequency Bureau that handled all the licensing. So he had honorary degrees from Harvard and Yale and Stanford, and I can't begin to tell you, there were just many, many of them, and he would pore over these with the three tour guides, me included. By the way, I was the only one who was ever a tour guide. The other two people left RCA before it actually got going. The library was actually open. The one thing he told us to watch for was this one honorary diploma is the word I was struggling for. And that was from Stuyvesant High School in New York City. It was the only high school that ever gave him a degree. He never finished the eighth grade. He was a Russian immigrant. Came into the United States, thought he was applying to deliver telegrams by bicycle because he had just bought himself a bicycle. I don't know how, he's selling fruit or something. And didn't realize that he had signed up to become a telegraph operator. And that's how he got started in radio. It was a good thing, because he also then was a confrere of Vladimir Zworykin, who is credited by many as developing television in the first place, and it was Sarnoff who got Zworykin to come to RCA so that RCA became the father of television. So, oh dear, it goes on and on, Diana. Yeah, don't get me started.
The American dream at work there.
Oh, it was, yeah, by a couple of Russians.
You've been listening to a pre-recorded conversation with radio and television broadcast veteran John Bowker on this interview segment of Morning Edition. I'm Diana Gish.
With a very short time to go before the start of the new winter season, here are the details of the times and frequencies for English language programs as from Sunday the 25th of September. There's a very low sunspot count at the moment, which means that shortwave stations are forced to use the lower frequency bands, and that leads to overcrowding. In order to improve our chances, we're spreading out some of the broadcast times, as well as swapping around the use of some of our transmitter sites.
At 23:30 UTC, we sign on using 6020 and 6165 kHz, both this time from our Bonaire relay station. At midnight 30, 6020 and 6165 kHz continue, and they're joined by 11655 and 9840 kHz from our Madagascar relay station. Again, the beam is to North America. And finally, at 0330 UTC, 6015 and 6165 kHz are available for the North American West Coast. Our programme schedule, on target, is at the printers at the moment, delayed, I'm afraid, by the last stage in our reorganisation here at Radio Netherlands. But we'll be announcing the new schedule regularly over the next few days at 25 minutes past the hour to give you a second chance to copy down the details.